Hi, Steve Pomerantz here, host of On the Money with today's On the Money Extra, where we feature market updates and insights as well as guest interviews with noted financial experts to help you stay informed and learn the facts to make the right decisions about money. So let's get started. In today's world, we all seek out specialists in the area we are least competent, whether it's seeking medical advice, legal advice, or investment advice. So, how does one navigate through the investment world to ensure that they get the right advisor? To explore this question, I've asked Mark Chucci, Senior Vice President of Guidance and Advice at United Capital Financial Life Management, to discuss this very issue. And by way of disclosure, both Mark and I are senior level executives at United Capital. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, Steve. Happy to be here.
So, if someone either already has an investment person or is thinking about getting help for the first time, describe the investment profession landscape to our listeners.
Well, I think, Steve, you hit it right on the head. You used the phrase investment profession. And in the investment profession, of course, the focus is on investments. And that, unfortunately, in my opinion, that investments often are seen as the end in itself, rather than what they actually are, which is simply the means to an end.
Well, you know, historically, the profession's been about selling things like stocks, mutual funds, and annuities. Is that still a big part of the business?
Unfortunately, it is. You know, people ask me what the standard value proposition is in our industry, and my answer is more often than not, it's in essence, my dog is prettier than your dog, or my dad can beat up your dad, is frankly, just another way of saying that I have a superior investment strategy, and as a consequence, you should be comfortable placing your money with me.
So I guess it's all driven. It's still a lot of thinking about performance and who can beat the next guy. But, you know, everyone these days calls themselves investment or financial advisors. What makes a person a true investment advisor versus one who calls himself one?
I think if you're really going to live the promise of the profession, you have to be willing to put first things first. In other words, I need to understand what you as a client value about money. I need to understand the purpose that money will serve in your life. I need to understand what are the things that are important to you, whether it's a comfortable retirement, whether it's educating your children, buying a home, a second home. I mean, those are the things that at the end of the day are going to determine the quality of the life you live, not whether your portfolio out or underperformed the index by 1%.
Well, when a person speaks to an investment professional for the first time, what kind of questions should they ask him or her? What are they looking to find out in order for them to make a good decision?
I think you need to find out what is your approach to working with clients. In other words, how are you going to help me accomplish the things that, what specific steps are you going to take? What specific tools are you going to be using? And how will those be used in my specific case? And can you show me some examples of the work that you do?
If a person starts by saying, let me look at your statement, let me see your portfolio, and starts immediately recommending investments, what should a person do?
Run away as quickly as possible.
Run away.
Unless, again, you're hiring a specific person to manage a specific investment strategy the way a pension plan or an endowment, you know, might hand a large cap manager a specific piece of money. And in that particular circumstance, of course, how well the manager does at managing large cap value stocks is eminently important.
Yeah.
But for the individual investor, you know, you're looking for somebody who's not only going to build a diversified portfolio and manage that portfolio over time, but more importantly, is going to place that money in the service of the things that you truly value. And how they go about doing that, in my opinion, is the single most important criteria for choosing a financial advisor.
So how does a person know what they should value when you listen to the media or in any shape or form, TV or print? So much is talking about you know, what kind of rate of return. You mentioned, you know, my dad can beat your dad, or, you know, I'll get you up the hill for the first time, you know, to be the first at the top of the hill. I guess, is anybody really asking the question, are we climbing the right hill? Is this the right hill that we should be climbing? How does one determine what it is that they need so they can ask those correct questions?
Well, again, you know, everybody knows what they value when it comes to money, whether it's protecting their lifestyle, whether it's making sure their family's protected, whether it's educating the people they care about, whether it's some type of a legacy. I mean, people value what they value, and all they need is an advisor who's willing to take the time to ask, to do the discovery necessary to understand what those things mean to each individual, and to craft a plan of action that has the highest possible probability of actually achieving the things that the client feels are important. And I think a great example is, you know, if the market went down 35% in 2007 and your portfolio only lost 30%, then your advisor met the criteria of outperforming the market. My guess is that they probably weren't getting a lot of high fives for losing 30% of your money.
Yeah.
Even more importantly, did you need to be taking that amount of risk in the first place?
Yeah, so the risk is a very important question. I know it's something that comes up in my discussions with people all the time. How much risk should I take? You know, the standard for the industry is something that's called a risk tolerance questionnaire. Describe one of those briefly, and let's talk about some of the pros and cons of those.
Well, I can do both at the same time and save you a few minutes here. So when stocks are doing really, really well, do people love them or hate them?
They love them.
And when you love something, do you want more of it or less of it?
I want more.
Absolutely. And when stocks are in the tank, do people love them or hate them?
Hate them.
And if you hate something, do you want more of it or less of it?
Less.
So if your investment strategy is to buy high, sell low, and repeat until broke, then investment and risk tolerance questionnaires are the perfect tool to help you do it.
Why do they do that?
They don't have anything better.
No, I mean, what is it in the questionnaire that makes you end up buying high and selling low?
Well, because all risk tolerance questionnaires, without regard to their level of sophistication, are designed to answer a simple question. What percentage of my portfolio should be allocated to risky investments like stocks?
Mm-hmm.
And the more I feel good about stocks, no matter how carefully crafted the questionnaire is, my answers are going to lead my advisor to disproportionately weight my portfolio towards stocks. And exactly the opposite.
Well, one of the questions has to be, you know, where is your break point? If the market goes down by X, is that acceptable to you? Could you live with that? What is your sleep at night number? What do you think about that kind of question?
Well, it assumes that that is the only thing that you have control over, and it's not. You can control how much you save while you're working, how much you spend towards those things that you value, like education and retirement. You can control the legacy you leave behind, whether that's during your lifetime or at death. You can control all sorts of things other than just your allocation to equities. And so if the proposition was, would you rather be willing to take a 30% loss in the market or work one more year? That's going to give you an entirely different answer than if you simply ask somebody, what would your response be if you lost 30% in the market?
Well, how does one know? How does one know to be able to answer that question as whether working one more year and taking less risk would have an appropriate outcome for me? How do you actually measure something like that?
That's a great question. And frankly, that's something that our profession is constantly working and studying and adapting, much like you mentioned the medical profession earlier. As more technology, better imaging systems, MRIs, advanced CAT scan technologies, as those tools become available, doctors use better tools to give better guidance, to give better advice, to make better diagnosis and better recommendations. And the same thing is true in our profession. Planning, financial planning software has been around as long as there have been Excel spreadsheets, and that technology has been adapting and evolving, and particularly to help answer those types of questions. So as an advisor, I need a tool And that tool needs to be able to take all of your unique inputs. So what is it that you wish to accomplish? What are the resources that you have available to accomplish those things? And then what is the probability that it's going to work out well for you? And by probability, we're talking simply about a range of outcomes. If, in other words, I simulate 1,000 different future markets, and I say, I want to be successful at least 75% of the time because I don't want to run the risk of running out of money, that would be a very valid methodology. And a lot of the crude rules you see out there, like the 4% rule, are designed to maximize the probability that people won't run out of money.
I get asked about the 4% rule all the time. What is the latest thinking about the 4% rule?
Well, it's not 4% anymore. It's down to, I think, the 3.5% rule now. But again, it ignores the other control factors, those other things that you can personally influence. And it also ignores the other side of the argument. In other words, if I want there to be a 95% chance I don't run out of money, I'm also saying I want a 95% chance I'm going to be leaving a significant legacy behind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens if I don't have any kids or anybody to leave money to, or frankly, just don't care to? You know, then you have a strategy that's designed to produce an outcome that you as the client don't actually value.
You know, in our neck of the woods, we work and talk to a lot of people that actually experience what you've just described. Many of the people we speak to operate out of a sense of fear. We call that the fear money mind. And many of them, you know, don't really have legacy goals, a legacy defined as how much you're going to leave behind to your family and others, the legacy, or to a charity or something of that nature. So if people, on the one hand, are fearful and they're not really considering leaving a legacy because they're more worried about whether they're going to have enough money for themselves, that fear forces them to spend less, generally, to save more. And many times they end up saving more than they really have to, spending less than they really have to, and they end up doing exactly what it is they said they didn't really want to do, which was to leave a lot of money behind.
Exactly. And in fact, it creates a conflict of interest with the very advisor they're hiring to steward their values.
Why
in other words, the more money the advisor manages, the better it is for the advisor.
Mm-hmm. So parse that out a bit. So if the client spends more money, that's bad for the advisor, right?
Well, of course, it means that there's less money for the advisor to manage, unless the advisor cares about things like how their clients feel, how well they do, how likely they are to refer people that they genuinely care about. And so there are business metrics that are, in my opinion anyways, far more important then am I maximizing the amount of revenue that I can generate from a group of clients.
Right. Well, I guess that's one question to listen for when these issues, if these issues ever come to the table. Many times they won't, you know, investment people aren't necessarily trained to talk about these issues. But those who are, you want to listen to see whether they're saying, hey, you are in fact overfunded for your goals. You have more than enough money, so spend a little more. And if you hear that, perhaps that means that they are thinking more about your interest than their own.
Yeah, and I think a great example of that is the question, should I pay off my house?
Okay, take us through that.
Well, if you analyze, should I pay off my home, right? You know for a fact that over any extended period of time, the return you get in the market is going to be greater than the cost of a mortgage. And so the technical answer will invariably be, no, you should not pay off your mortgage. You should continue to keep the money invested, and you're going to end up with more at the end. Well, that presumes that they value having more at the end more than they value the peace of mind of not having a mortgage.
Great point. When measuring these outcomes that you speak about, I mean, we live in actually, we've been pretty lucky since 2004, but we basically do live in a hurricane-rife environment area. And so when hurricanes are said to be coming our way, they don't say they're going to land in Central Florida at a given date and a given time. They talk about a probability of this happening, and that probability changes really every time they take a reading, almost like a GPS system. You know, I know that we do the same thing, and there's something you and I have talked about in the past. And you talk about living between two guardrails. Describe that for us quickly.
Well, I love the hurricane metaphor. It's perfect, actually. You don't need to know you're in the center to take appropriate action, right? You just need to know that there's a sufficient probability that you need to start stocking up on bottled water and thinking about putting some plywood on the windows.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing is true of your financial life. You know, if we simulate those same 1,000 financial outcomes, those same future markets, and you're only successful 50 or 60% of the time, or frankly, anything under 75%, then you really are running the risk of running out of money. On the other hand, if you're above 90, which is a little bit counterintuitive, people would think that higher is better. Now, if you get above 90%, then you're really running the risk of, as I like to say, burdening your heirs with unearned wealth.
I'm sure the heirs don't think that's a problem.
In meetings, they have never been known to complain.
So you talk about the two guardrails, the one of being, in the one case, underfunded, the other being overfunded to meet your goals. Unfortunately, we're bumping up against the guardrail of time right now. Mark Chucci is my guest, Senior Vice President of Guidance and Advice at United Capital Financial Life Management. We're discussing this idea of how to pick a true professional investment person in your life and how to actually figure out how to live your one best life. And it's not all about, you know, beating the market's return. It's just about making sure that you get what you want. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Steve, it's been my pleasure. You have a great week.
To find out more about Mark and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at onthemoneyradio.org.
You're listening to On the Money with Certified Financial Planner Steve Pomerantz. If you'd like information about guests, topics, or anything you hear on this program, call 866-MONEY01 or visit the show's website at onthemoneyradio.org.